And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey, everybody, here we are in the middle of our Eastern Columbia Art Deco wonder.
Dean, what will it be today?
I am Dean Haglund, and singing off key is our co-host Phil Lernis for your Chill Pack Hollywood Art.
I am not the singer of our theme song. No, let's put an end to that rumor right now.
That rumor was never started. It's clearly the B-side extra.
It is the B-film extras.
Yes, they never, ever said, hey, does that sound like Phil singing that?
I am filmmaker, rock on tour. Podiatrist to the stars. Oh, no, right. A violence prevention specialist.
The sheriff. Oofity oof.
Phil Lernis.
There you go.
And this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and what a show we have for you today.
Boy, we have Stanley Cup fever, don't we? We certainly do. I brought out my New Year's Eve LA Kings Stanley Cup crown.
You did, because if you hadn't, would it be sitting in front of me? What?
I thought we'd wear it today for everyone listening.
I couldn't care less about the LA Kings and the Stanley Cup. In fact, I have antipathy, if I'm using that word correctly, towards the Kings in their pursuit of it for a couple of reasons.
Number one.
All the bandwagon jumpers.
Yes.
Which would be everyone in Los Angeles.
Well, the Clippers lost, the Lakers lost. Who else are you going to go and do the Staples?
Yeah, as if the bandwagon jumping of the Clippers wasn't bad enough this 1 year out of 20 when they're good. Every 20 years they're good, whether they need to be or not.
Right.
And now the Kings, nobody here cares about hockey or watches hockey. I'm not saying
there's
you
a lot
don't.
Of Canadian expats here.
Of course. But really, it is outrageous. Agree. And when they win, and when there are riots here in the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, as there is when the Lakers win, it's going to be doubly annoying for you because none of these people cared about hockey.
I don't think there's going to be riots because the hockey fans are different. They get drunk. But they're not out there burning and fighting and screaming.
And plus, the game itself is indistinguishable from a riot.
Exactly.
Right. I went to a riot and a hockey game broke out.
Totally.
Is the old joke or something.
Exactly.
Along the lines. The other reason that I'm not
thrilled.
Really rooting for them, is, you know, they were the bottom seed, weren't they, in this whole thing?
Well, fifth seed, not bottom.
I thought they were like eighth or something.
Or eighth, yeah, something like that.
I just
that.
Don't think a seed that low should be anywhere near a champion.
They in the middle of the season, got a new, from Canada, Daryl Sutter. He was like a really good hockey player back in when I watched hockey as a kid. And now he's coaching these guys right up to the big final game.
With a big opening all about hockey, it's safe to say we will not be written up on this week's This Week in Comedy Podcasts over at Splitsider like we were last week.
Exactly.
And what a good show that was.
Was that a good show?
The show with French Stewart and Jamie Robledo of Stoneface.
Wasn't that good?
It really was a funny show. I mean, I actually just accidentally heard, believe it or not, the first couple minutes of the show. The circumstances are bizarre and too obscure even to discuss or describe.
You don't
Nevertheless,
know
I heard the first couple minutes and they had me really busting up. I mean, even the opening before we got to them.
I'm trying to explain what the hell is going on.
And then when French Stewart introduces himself as TV's French Stewart, and you take umbrage at that by saying, hey, I'm TV's Dean Haglund. Remember that? And French Stewart says something along the lines of, okay, we can do that.
I was going to say, that's the moniker we use here sometimes.
Indeed, you are TV's Dean Haglund. And forever, you two TV's Dean Haglund.
Have you been following my tweets?
Dean Haglund has just left the building. I love when you get up and walk away from the microphone and ask me a question in the process. You know, in addition...
I'm getting a chill pack.
In addition to getting a lovely write-up there on Splitsider and This Week in Comedy Podcasts, I was featured on an installment of Getting Better Acquainted, Dave Pickering's podcast.
Really?
Last week, that episode dropped. We recorded it when I was in London.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of fun. And it became available just this past Wednesday. And people can check it out. It's a really good show, not just because I'm on it. I mean, every week it's a good show. He does a fantastic show. And it's just about him interviewing people who he meets in the daily course of his life.
Now, I guess listeners of our show wouldn't have to necessarily listen to you be reacquainted with somebody.
Right.
Because we would already know you.
Right. Although you might be surprised at some of the questions Dave Pickering comes up with. The whole discussion about snakes and throwing things out of the window is fascinating. You'll certainly learn a lot about Dave.
Oh, really?
And anyway, his show is at gettingbetteracquainted.co.uk.
Love it.
Promised to give a plug there.
I might listen to that.
Got a wonderful note written to me
from an email
by Chrissy Raven Kilna.
Ah, yes.
It was actually, I think, a wall post on Facebook.
Very good.
And she wrote to me.
Not me.
You once said there was nothing quite as long as a short film.
You did say that.
We made a short film this past weekend, and we had that quote as a reminder.
Ah, look at you go.
It's tight, fast-paced, and on a test screening, the audience wanted more. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Chrissy Raven Kilna, I think I speak for me when I say, you're welcome.
You do. I'm not participating in that.
And we would love to see it.
Yes, we would.
We always are interested in seeing the things that...
we inspire.
Or just our listeners are up to, because as we've talked about before, we have... an incredibly diverse and
eclectic
and talented audience that's up to really, really interesting things.
It's true.
And I got to tell you, every time I meet these people, I'm always struck by how easy on the eyes they are. We really do. Don't kid yourself. We may not have the largest podcast audience in the world, but I would say we probably have the most attractive podcast audience.
Are we doing that marketing?
And certainly... sweet smelling.
Oh, well, yes. Now that's, you've gone across the line.
I'm talking to you, Sean Parker.
This just got awkward in 10 degrees.
It's kind of fun when we've been away for a couple of weeks. I have so much energy.
I know. You got sleep or something? What happened?
I kind of did. It was a good, you know, I was traveling last week.
Yes, you were. You were way all the way up in California somewhere.
Yeah, we are in California still.
Yeah, but you're up in California. The up part.
And... you know, I was visiting, among other things, I was visiting my family, and my mother was stressing to me.
About me hitchhiking to Vegas again?
No, she has let go of that finally. Oh, and now it's about sleep schedule, and it's about, she has learned this perhaps the hard way herself, has been enduring some health challenges, and just, you know, stressing upon me... the reality that when we allow our sleep even to be interrupted for one night, the repercussions of that are felt for...
echoes.
Weeks.
Yes.
It's not like the next night I'll catch up.
Right. No.
And I'm really starting to feel that. I'm at that point in life where it kind of, not that you ever make up for it, but it takes almost one bad night of sleep, one night without sleep, it takes almost a week.
Absolutely.
To
like
fully
jet lag.
Feel good again.
It's called our circadian rhythms, and these are biological time clocks in our system that once you start waking up at certain hours or going to sleep at certain hours, the body adjusts and thinks those are the actual rhythms. You know, they did that interesting experiment where they put a guy down in the cave for 6 to 9 months and just left one light on to see how the body would actually time itself to circadian rhythms. And turns out we're on a 26-hour clock. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, it's not 24, it's 26, believe it or not. So technically that 2 hours is our play shift time, that you can wake up an hour early or go to bed an hour late and still be within the circadian rhythms.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, but other than that, then you're way off. And that was an experiment they did in the 70s in a cave.
That explains that really does explain a great deal.
I know, doesn't it?
And then let me ask you this.
Yes.
Yes, you.
I'm right
Dr.
here.
Dr. Dean Haglund.
The guy with too much information.
Can I do what you suggested? For example, unlike I think what is physically supposed to happen, I get jet lag when I travel west, not when I travel east.
Yeah, oddly enough.
You suggested that I begin to adjust my
time
going to bed.
In the London area.
Yeah,
before
for
you
example.
Come in. Yeah.
Nights leading up to it that I adjusted. So then within these circadian rhythms, is such a thing possible? Can you start to shift that clock?
Yeah, you can over in like across the pond, as they would say. Absolutely. And I've done it a number of times going over where I'll start staying up later and watching what the time is to the place I'm going. So I'm always thinking already in that other time zone.
So if you have a gig coming up, let's say, where you're going to be shooting nights, yes, or you're doing a Broadway show, right? And
let's
we know the lifetime, unlike LA even theater, in Broadway, in New York, it really is a case where you're going up to dinner after the show.
Yeah.
Because that's when everyone's out and that's when you're having meetings and this is when it's happening. So your day is not over with the performance. You're then having dinner, and then after dinner, you should stay up for a few hours to digest.
Yes. Some even work out at that point.
So if you're doing night shoots, or if you know like a gig like this, then is it possible, if you have enough advance notice, to start adjusting
forward to that? Yeah, and you should do it in increments. Like, it's not a one day I'm going to start just going to bed at 8 a.m. And
I wonder how long really you would need to be able to.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I think it's longer than you probably get. I think it's longer than an advance warning you would get. Because yes, when you think about the fact that, for example, the Broadway show, you're probably in rehearsals leading up to opening night, and the rehearsals are probably during the day.
Yeah, totally. And so, yeah. And for instance, when I did The Fringe a couple of years ago, that was what I did before I headed over, for sure. So that when I would be there, I'd be at my brightest and not my sleepiest when I hit the stage at 8 p.m.
Well, it's fascinating. We're actually talking about shifting time and how our body deals with time. This is going to become a kind of a theme in this episode.
Really?
I wanted to mention that when I got back into town, though.
Yes.
Well, yeah, because don't kid yourself. There is a theme to this week's show.
Oh, wow. I can't.
Two words. Time travel.
Wow.
I when I got back into town, one of the things that I did this weekend was I attended another graduation, another school graduation. A few weeks ago, I attended Nathan Baker's graduation from high school at St. Francis High School. His youngest brother, Aaron Baker, was graduating from elementary school, eighth grade, St. Philip the Apostle School. The last time I had been in that church there at St. Philip's was when I was attending Grandparents and Special Friends Day at the school as the special friend of first grader Aaron Baker.
Oh.
And now here I was attending his graduation from eighth grade.
Wow.
Some 7 years later.
Time has flown.
Ooh, yeah, and it does not feel like 7 years.
Right. Never does.
Although the graduation ceremony itself felt like 7 years. Amazing how an elementary school could take twice as long as a high school did to pull off a graduation ceremony.
You know, I imagine it's more organizational problems.
A lot of awards given out. And don't kid yourself, my boy Aaron Baker was collecting quite the stash.
Really? Good for him.
Accepted with honors to St. Francis High School. So congratulations, Aaron. I bring this up, though, because Father Joe gave the opening speech.
Dear old Father Joe.
And he had a phrase that, again, much like there were some phrases at the St. Francis graduation
that
disturbed me and some that inspired me, this I found, again, to be rather extraordinarily inspiring, especially coming from a priest. And again, I don't go to church, so I don't know, but this is the sort of thing that really makes me feel good about, you know, religion.
Comparative religion.
Father Joe said to those in attendance, life is not about waiting for the storm to pass.
Uh-huh.
It's about learning to dance in the rain.
Ah. And then he broke out into Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly.
Wow, you ruined it.
Did I ruin it? No, I thought that was very inspiring. You know, Singing in the Rain is an inspirational piece as well for dancing in the rain. That metaphor.
And about the death of careers with the advent of talkies.
Separate that from the musical number itself, Singing in the Rain.
I went to the state capitol, to Sacramento, to meet with some people. And one of the places I visited this time, and I had not been there in a long time, was Old Town, right on the river.
Mm-hmm. I've never actually been there.
This is very much a time capsule.
Is it?
I mean, it looks...
The Wild West.
Indeed.
Yes.
And you're aware that this was kind of one of the first big cities in the West. And it's so odd to me to think about this, but we noticed it when we were there. I mean, there's a river. It's a port city.
It's a port
Sacramento.
City.
Sacramento. There's a river that goes through it.
That river that connects to the San Francisco Bay, that connects to the ocean, that you can...
The delta, I guess, right?
Yeah, and, that you can move goods up there all the way to Sacramento.
But it really was, you know, kind of being in an odd time capsule.
Do they still have a plywood boardwalk?
Yeah.
They do, do they?
Yes. Yeah.
I remember seeing pictures of that going, well, that looks pretty well.
Gravel roads and...
In Old Town, gravel roads? Really? Wow. So what were you doing there? Just hanging out?
I had a meeting later on in the evening, and I had some hours to kill, and so I just went there and walked around. And
I'm shocked we didn't go when we did our screening up there.
Yeah.
Well, that seems remarkable.
We had time, but who knew?
Who knew? Who knew? Sacramento had so much to offer. For all you looking for a tourist outlet, we can't recommend Sacramento enough, be it the one theater we went to or the Holiday Inn. Where'd we go? Where we have that breakfast? International House of Pancakes.
The International House of Pancakes. Yes. They're not a sponsor, so who cares?
Yeah, tell it.
As we mentioned, we did a show last week that was entirely dedicated, our first show ever entirely dedicated to a live event of the week.
Yes.
Another show that we featured as a live event of the week was Clybourn Park when it was playing here at the Mark Taper Forum.
Uh-huh.
Did you see that it won the Tony last night for Best Play?
I did not see that.
Another sign of how influential your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour has become.
When we mention it on our live event of the week, suddenly everyone in New York takes notice.
I was not able to watch all of the Tony Awards.
Because?
Because I was not going to watch the Tony Awards.
Right.
Also, because I was attending this week's live event.
What?
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Yes, I attended last night David Dean Bottrell's fantastic one-man show. It was back. It played to sold-out audiences about a year ago, had a long run, and it was back for two nights.
Two nights
part
only.
Part of Hollywood Fringe.
Yes.
The next performance is on June 23rd. June we'll do 23rd. A link on our website
I
there.
Might go if you recommend it enough.
It's David Dean Bottrell Makes Love. Saw it at Theater Asylum as a part of Hollywood Fringe. Huge turnout. Seriously, a huge and enthusiastic turnout. I have never seen a line. You know, it's on Theater Row there in Santa Monica in Hollywood. And I had never seen a line like that outside of
to a theater
before.
Oh, fantastic. Because, you know, the Hollywood Fringe is always marked by all other fringe festivals around the world for the fact that you are in an epicenter of entertainment, and yet no one knows a fringe festival is going on in this town.
And and it's all word of mouth. There's no advertising.
There's
yet I think that this bodes well.
Yes.
It's a fantastic show. He is truly a wonderful storyteller and writer. And actor. We loved him in his Emmy-winning role as the creepy and delightful Lincoln Meyer on Boston Legal.
So good.
And I'll let you in on a little secret.
What's
just
that?
Between you and me.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking forward to studying acting from David Dean Bottrell.
What?
Beginning next month.
Knock me over with a feather. What are you talking about?
That's just a little secret.
You're
we'll
going to take an
we'll
acting class
that.
With David
Dean? I am going to. Every so often I like to do an acting class. And he does teach, I would imagine, is a wonderful teacher. I've heard great things about him. And I just get the feeling for especially a director and a writer, he's a good guy to be studying from.
I bet he is.
You know,
that's awesome. Are you looking to get an agent? Is this what's happening?
No, I mean, I always do these things just with the idea of it's good to...
Keep
my chops, but also keep... in mind what an actor is going through when they're preparing and what kind of feedback they need or might like from a director. Putting myself in someone else's shoes.
Very smart.
Especially when I'm going to be working with actors. So
right.
That's what they're doing.
The play, by the way, was it funny and sold out?
It's incredibly funny. And it's really, that's what it's about. It's about David Dean Bottrell making love.
And all his love
stories
gone
about
to hell.
Yeah, love stories gone to hell.
Exactly. I love it.
Love in its many forms,
fantastic.
In its many varied and wildly entertaining forms. I also saw at the Steve Allen Theater,
right up the street from you,
Janet Klein and her Parlor Boys. And this is a show that's been playing for 8 years. Every month, I finally got around to seeing this. Janet Klein. Is a singer. Her Parlor Boys are her backing band.
Right.
And they are in the Depression.
Uh-huh.
The music is all from the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s.
Vintage.
And they are...
Like a country band.
To them, not a country band. I mean, right. They're Americana.
I see. Yeah.
Of that era. And they are performing as if it's still, you know, the 1930s.
Ah, I see.
You know, trying to lift our spirits right. during the Depression. Not that we would know anything at all about such economic upheaval.
Right.
In this
or
time.
Environmental upheaval in the Dust Bowl.
And I wish I had jotted down who the man was that programs the short films that play before they take the stage.
Uh-huh.
But it's always these very historic, you know, like a Vitaphone.
Sure. Vitaphones, yeah. Those are classic newsreels.
And all of these this time around were music related, like they showed three big band performances. I mean, it was almost like their version of music videos.
Oh, yeah, you know, exactly.
And the Red Nichols band especially knocked me on my ass. And getting to see young announcer Burt Parks introduce one of these was a lot of fun.
That's great.
Again, it was a bit of time travel.
Uh-huh.
And getting to see one of the original Oswald the Rabbit shorts.
Cartoons, yes.
Cartoons. Now, this was Walt Disney's first big creation.
Yeah, before Mickey Mouse, there was Oswald the Rabbit.
And he did not own the rights to the character. Was it Universal or Warner Brothers?
I think Universal, or maybe it was Warner Brothers. But,
because it was, I guess, a work for hire.
Yeah.
So then they owned the rights. But recently, the Disney Corporation, just bought the rights back to Oswald Rabbit. So he is now
fully
in the fold. All of Disney's creations are back in the fold.
And you know what's remarkable? If you saw that at the Steve Allen Theater, the creation of that was not just three blocks from that theater, which was Disney's original studio, which is right at Prospect and Vermont.
And this is one of the things that you love. You talk about this in Truth Is Out There. You know, you said the origins of film, and it's still going on all around us, is what you say in the movie. And I always thought that was a very interesting turn of phrase, because on the one hand, we understand what you mean, that filming is still going on all around us, but in a way, the origins of film are still going on all around us.
Yeah, that the creative impulse that started it all is still there.
And we still do draw in inspiration from it and influence it. That's why we're seeing Janet Klein in the Parlor Boys. That's why we do know about Chaplin's and studios.
Yeah.
And people might say, oh no, Hollywood doesn't care. I mean, it's easy to say that they don't, because we are at a time when, for example, only one studio has an archive anymore.
Right.
On the other hand, as I'll talk about, there are enough examples to show, no, you know, this, people do still draw a lot of inspiration and a lot of joy, and the enthusiasm with which they express this joy and acknowledge this inspiration makes you think that that the ramifications of that joy and that inspiration are going to continue to be felt.
Absolutely. When you come to Hollywood, you realize you're standing on the shoulders of giants who came before you. And all of that evidence is not just there in terms of the work that you can still see on DVD and on YouTube, but on the physical locations of where they worked and how they worked and what the conditions that they were working in. You know, when you think of Chaplin doing all that physical comedy in Los Angeles, there was heat waves back then. They would have been, you know, the Keystone Cops falling off the back of a Model T Ford and 105 degree heat in the middle of the summer while filming that stuff. Not an easy task, my friend.
Well, we always talk about what we're reading.
Yes.
We haven't in a couple of weeks.
No.
One of the things that I'm reading is Stephen Jacobs' authorized biography of Boris Karloff, More Than a Monster. And I mentioned my misgivings about it when I started reading it. And I've got to tell you, because it is very dense, and it's almost at the outset reads a little bit like a term paper, you know, so heavy with dates and names and figures. It's really, the information is staggering. And it takes a little while to get into that kind of approach. But now, being almost 200 pages into this, I'm loving it.
Oh, awesome.
I'm loving the information that I'm getting. And of course, the story of Boris Karloff is, to a degree, the story of the origins of film. And
yeah.
and not just because he started in silent and then became one of the first real talky movie stars.
Yeah.
Because of his extensive experience on the stage.
His huge theater
especially
work
in Canada.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because he left his native England and went to Canada to make a name for himself and worked stock and these repertory companies traveling. So many of the towns that I visited with you when we were making Truth Is Out There.
Had little theaters in there that would do live theater.
Kamloops. And so that training really, and it was, he had been doing silent film, but it was really, again, doing a stage show in L.A. where he really kind of got discovered for the monster in Frankenstein because they said, oh, this guy has what it takes to act this role.
Yeah.
And, but he's also, his story is the story politically of some of the origins of Hollywood.
Really?
That still is felt today. I mean, one of the first seven for the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, I did.
The only one really risking everything because he was the one who was a star, and if they'd found out that he was involved in organizing this, he could have lost everything.
Wow.
And he introduced some of the, you know, the original officers like Groucho Marx and Jimmy Cagney to this cause and to what was being done. So it's fascinating stuff. And again, another kind of sort of time travel trip for me in doing this. And what's really fun, especially in this city. Look, one of the reasons I love reading and one of the reasons I love taking public transportation is the conversations you can get in with strangers over the book that you're reading.
Yes.
It's a wonderful inn that people have to engage you in conversation.
As in, what are you reading? And
asking you about the book or if they know something about that topic.
Right.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then the conversation can become as intimate and as revealing as either of the participants want it to be.
Yeah.
But it's good conversation talking about books. And I had such an experience
being
here in L.A. The other day on a bus, I was reading Karloff, and this old-timer, Curtis, old African-American gentleman, started talking to me about Karloff. And then somehow I started telling him the story about Edmund Kean's sword and Shakespearean lore. And then he started hitting me with the work that Henry Wilcox, and the great Shakespearean actor, did with DeMille during the silent era.
Of course.
And then he's hitting me with information about Disney and how it was Disney who in 55 inspired Curtis to come to Hollywood.
Oh,
and
I didn't know that.
Just, again, you know, this all these time capsule elements that are still alive because they still inform our inspirations of why we're here. And it's again, books opened the door to that, not going and seeing a movie,
right?
Reading about our history,
Hollywood history,
made this connection. Are you still reading about Paris in the 20s?
I am. I'm on my last couple chapters there with the doctors that were over there, and then I've just picked up Dr. Daniel's book PhD about running, because I am starting an 18-week training schedule to run the Long Beach Marathon this October. I'm running 26 miles.
Wow.
26.2 miles, nonetheless. And it's in Long Beach, where it's a little flatter than the L.A. Marathon. So I thought since I blew my soleus out at the old San Pedro half marathon a couple weeks ago, it'd be smarter to do a full marathon in October in Long Beach, where you run along the beach for a good chunk of it, where it's flat.
Wow.
Yes, I know. So I started reading that book called Running, and start my training schedule starting today. I did 3 miles with the dogs. Look at me go.
Look at you go.
I know. This is a whole new Dean Haglund right here. Kid yourself.
The other book that I had been reading, and I finished it since we last spoke about books, was Nick Cook's The Hunt for 0 Point.
Oh, yes. How'd that end?
Did he find really it? Great book. Well, it's interesting because the investigation is more the hunt for anti-gravity propulsion, because this is a journalist within the defense industry. He wrote for the defense industry, and it
Jane's
was his
magazine.
Investigation into this, and harnessing the 0 point is what it led him into.
Right.
And you're free to draw your own conclusions. He lets you know what his conclusions are. He makes it very clear what can be proven, what can't be proven. He lets you know how, from his experience, black ops, or not black ops, but you know, the
black budget
research programs operate, And it's very interesting. And I'm left to say that, you know, of course there are people doing investigation into harnessing zero point.
Yeah.
And
it would be silly not to.
And it's certainly part of the things that we are going to be investigating in Truth Is Out There 2. Since we're mentioning Truth Is Out There 2, let's take a little break.
Of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail. And there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subjective.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
Wasn't that fun?
Yes. As if we hadn't heard it before.
Yes.
You know, this theme of time travel that's sort of emerging is appropriate for a couple of reasons. One, because in the follow-up to Truth Is Out There, Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, we're going to be visiting in Europe, Domenhur. And I've already conducted an interview with Dr. David Bramwell about this place.
Yes.
And it's an eco society based on ethical and spiritual values.
A hippie commune.
Awarded by an agency of the United Nations as a model for a sustainable future. And it was founded in 1975.
Yeah.
The Federation has about 1,000 citizens and extends over 500 hectares.
Yes.
I don't know how big that is.
That's about 1.3 hectares per acre.
And it's at the foothills of the Piedmont Alps.
Oh, good.
It offers courses all year round, and it's possible for people to visit for short periods, as well as longer stays for study, for vacation, or for regeneration, which sounds a little... I'm sending you for regeneration, and I am going to document that. Anyway, it's a fascinating society. So what does this have to do with ancient mysteries?
Yes, tell me this. Wonder.
And of course, part of it is, you know, this idea of living in peace and harmony with nature. Uh-huh. You do take your cues from previous societies.
Yeah.
And so it is this issue of how to look backwards to gain wisdom that we can take with us moving forward.
I know.
However, the larger thing about this is the fact that the cornerstone of this society...
Okay.
Is time travel.
Awesome.
It was founded by people, and the society itself claims to have mastered time travel.
Really? Oh, don't tell me anymore. I want to go see these guys.
So we will be, of course, investigating this in Truth Is Out There.
Because you know my bugaboo is time travel movies, right? Like Time Cop. Where they, you know, you take a rocket sled through a brick wall and then suddenly you're in a different time zone. But somehow the rocket sled didn't come with you. It disappeared out through the wall, but you just fall out of the sky into a lake. You know, these sort of things that happen in time travel movies always bug me. So I'm fascinated to hear about it.
Well, here's the type of time travel that I sort of enjoy in movies. And it's to have made a movie called The Truth Is Out There and to find myself right back where we were a year ago. Where we almost have Blu-ray edition of the film. Because we do. Do we not?
Do.
We finally, thanks to the hard work of, and let's not kid ourselves, the generosity of Jason Weichelt,
yes,
and Ted's, and Sonic Pool, and Deluxe, we are in the process
of
manufacturing Blu-rays again. It has not been easy.
No.
If you've listened to past shows and you know... a bit about what we're going through, and Dean Haglund, you were on the phone with the FBI.
Oddly enough, I'm calling the real FBI.
Trying to get, you know, and they said initially that, you know, the satisfaction we're seeking is of a financial size, not really worth their attention.
Well, not in their ballywick of fraud. I mean, fraud sort of starts at a larger sum amount for their...
And yet... with all the assistance you gave the FBI over the years in helping them solve some of their most mysterious cases as Langley in the X-Files,
yes.
I certainly would hope that there would be quid pro quo.
You know, oddly enough, that did not come up in the phone conversation with the real FBI agent, though I'm sure many of them there at the office chose that career maybe because of watching the X-Files. I'm just guessing, but to say that over the phone while I'm trying to get some sort of recompense... for a Blu-ray fraud.
Hi, TV's Dean Haglund here.
Hi, you may be working because of a show you saw me on. What I need now is some help about a Blu-ray that went wrong. Yeah.
When you hear that I was on the X-Files, I know you're thinking to yourself, how can I help Dean Haglund?
And here's the answer. Yeah. No, I did not do that. Oddly enough, I'm somewhat more official on the phone.
When I think about time travel movies, though,
yes.
Really seriously, to your point...
Where do you go?
Always the discussion,
yes,
for me, goes to Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
And that, of course,
brings us to
celebrity deaths.
91 years old.
Yes.
Ray Bradbury died this past week.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we've talked about giants on this show before. You know, hard to find a modern figure, a figure of the 20th century who had... More of an impact.
It's true.
And more, and really gave more joy and pleasure to people.
Yeah.
He was of course, an author, a writer, a film producer, and screenwriter. You know, he owned the Fremont Theater in Pasadena, that tiny little theater,
and
continued to write one acts for it,
you
know, through the later years of his life.
Uh-huh.
I, of course, had the pleasure of working for Ray Bradbury at UCLA.
That's right.
When he taught extension courses there.
You were a TA?
And witness, no, I was you know, working in media design there, and was handed to him as his projectionist for his class.
Ah, yes.
Because he was a big wig.
Right.
And they wanted to make sure everything, and I wore sport coats, so that was why I was assigned the tough cases.
Hey, get the guy with the sports coat.
Because I was respectful,
coat.
Yeah.
We need the sports coat guy.
You know, do we go with the guys that have pierces in places that most people don't have places, or do we go with the guy in the sport coat?
Get that guy.
And I think I've shared this on the show before that
maybe.
I once, you know, it was so cool to be working with Ray Bradbury at UCLA. I mean, this is where he wrote Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
He wrote it in the university research library on hourly rental typewriters.
I did not know that.
And yeah, in a research library, wrote Fahrenheit 451. How great to be
ironic.
Surrounded by your
books.
Inspiration.
Totally.
Again, what we're talking about with Hollywood.
Yeah,
be
yeah.
surrounded by your inspiration while making that which you love. It's where better. But I would witness this where people would come up to him and need to tell them how much of a fan they were and how much they enjoyed his work. And more than once, I witnessed people come up to him to tell him how much they loved Star Trek. And he was very kind and gracious and received the compliment and moved on.
Right.
And much like I did a couple weeks ago when people came up to me to tell me how much they were a fan of my music, me being Peter Gabriel, of course.
Right.
And finally, when they asked, you know, are you Peter Gabriel? I said, yes, I am.
You broke down.
But... I did so perhaps from a different
standpoint.
Inspiration.
Yes. Yes.
Than he did.
Yours
he graciously
mocking.
Received it. And he you know, and I walking away, I told him how impressed I was with him that he could receive it so graciously. And he said there was a time when he would need to correct
people on
it. And then it just he got to the point, especially so when Gene Roddenberry died.
Yeah.
But he got to the point where he realized, you know, Star Trek was a great thing.
Right.
And these people who love it have such genuine affection for it in such a positive way that to receive it is such a gift for them.
Right.
They really want the opportunity to express gratitude. And so let them have that opportunity to express gratitude.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that's just kind of the coolest thing.
That is kind of
ever.
The coolest thing. I met him, get this, at an art gallery in Santa Monica It was just after Comic-Con. I thought this place would be packed. It was Ray Harryhausen sitting beside Ray Bradbury in this gallery for the work of Ray Harryhausen, who did the stop-motion animation for the Golden Voyage of Sinbad and all of the classics. And it was just the two of them sitting on a couple of chairs in a completely empty gallery. Maybe there was like six or seven people. I think I was one of the first one there. I went, two Rays sitting beside each other. And I just sort of had like a 10-minute conversation.
An evening of two Rays.
It was like my live event of the week from the 90s. And man, it was just so bizarre to think that, you know, here's these two cultural influences just sitting there and they're happy to talk to you. And like, it
reminds me of what Ringo Starr said when he hosted Saturday Night Live back in the 80s. He says people think that it's so glamorous being a living legend. Living legends don't have a lot to do, really, other than to kind of hang out with each other watching Star Trek. That's what Ringo Starr said.
That's true.
Any particular favorite Ray Bradbury? We won't list all his accomplishments, but any particular favorite Ray Bradbury?
I seen Fahrenheit 451 done three.
But any favorite books or any favorite?
I'm trying to think which is my. I'm still 451 is my favorite book.
Hard to go wrong. Yeah. I mean, one of the pieces that I have an incredible amount of affection for. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's one of his best.
Right.
I don't know, but I know that I had incredible affection for it because his affection came through. It's called Death is a Lonely Business.
Oh, yes.
And it was a kind of noirish mystery novel that he wrote. Now I'm thinking early 90s, right around the time I was working with him, and it was almost completely autobiographical. Uh-huh. Fictional, but very much drawn from his real experiences as a young fledgling magazine story writer and screenwriter who was under contract learning from the likes of John Huston, because it was a John Huston picture he first wrote. I think maybe Moby Dick.
Oh, really?
It was maybe his first screenwriting.
Wow.
But it was based on this time period. So it's what Los Angeles was like in the late 30s, early 40s, what Hollywood was like, what it was like working in the studio system, and it's a noir whodunit kind of story, and it's just so much love. I mean, that's just the word for it.
I'm gonna read that. What was that called again?
Death is a Lonely Business.
Death is a Lonely Business.
And the only, I guess our entree back to talking about Ray Bradbury, which is all about time travel. Whenever I think of time travel movies, time travel writing, I am immediately thrust back to what I felt when I was a little boy in second grade?
Could have been.
And assigned reading was A Sound of Thunder.
Ah, really? That's a pretty progressive school.
And what a story. I mean, you know, this is the short about the vacation tours to the ancient past to witness dinosaurs, to see dinosaurs roaming the earth. As long as you stay on the hyperbaric chamber path,
right,
so that you don't alter
in the time
anything, all hell breaks loose. I think someone accidentally steps on a butterfly, although I may just want to say butterfly because of the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
But someone just does something innocuous before coming back, and
all of reality's changed.
And yeah, spoiler alert.
Yes.
Nazis won World War II or something like that, right?
Right.
But, and it just, you know, I mean, I still remember the effect that story had on me as a little boy, and I remember sitting there reading it. I mean, I am back. I can viscerally remember the smells and feels and sights and the light, the fluorescent lights of that classroom.
Wow.
It brings me back to that moment.
Was this a public school where they're making you read Bradbury in the second grade?
That's pretty
intense.
And so isn't that amazing?
Yes.
It's about time travel. And here's a story that so captured my imagination and was so visceral, so plugged you into the adventure of it, that I am still physically plugged in to all the stimulus that were surrounding me at that time.
Fantastic.
So time travel, again, truly is possible.
Look at that. Even if it's in your mind.
Well, it's not in my mind.
Right.
It's within my
molecular
within my
structure.
Body.
Yeah.
That version of myself clearly is still within me.
And it'll come
and still experiencing
absolutely.
it.
Absolutely.
Ray Bradbury, 91 years old.
There you go.
I saw a few movies.
So did I.
Did you really?
I went to two whole movies.
Well, I don't think you did anything nearly as cool as what I did, speaking of this whole topic about time travel and being surrounded by the origins of Hollywood.
Sure.
For the first time ever, I attended one of the nights of Last Remaining Seats.
Oh, good for you.
This is the LA Conservancy's
yes.
annual film festival. Mm-hmm. 26th year
of
this film festival.
Of saving downtown theaters.
Saving historic landmark buildings in downtown Los
Not
Angeles.
Not just downtown, in Glendale as well.
True.
And Pasadena.
Of course, this is the first time ever that that historic LA Conservancy Film Festival, now in Beverly Hills, which is disappointing, they, well, but they go the where the money is.
Yeah.
But these things, so I went and saw at the Los Angeles Theater.
Yes.
The Paper Chaplin. Moon.
Ah.
Now, Los Angeles Theater was... at the time, the most opulent picture palace ever created.
Yes. And it still is.
It still is. So yeah. incredible.
It's amazing.
Going down to the salons, which is the euphemism for the bathrooms, but right. they are salons. They're like right. the Grand Salons of Versailles.
Yeah.
To go to the ladies' salon, you have to pass through this giant ballroom. It's several floors below the earth.
Yeah.
And you pass through this huge ballroom to get to the ladies' salon.
So you would never know it was under there because it's such a small little storefront of a theater, you would think.
And it, and this prism system still exists, like a periscope, submarine periscope yeah. system, where this series of mirrors... women could go down into the ballroom and they could chat and socialize while still watching the movie through the system, and it's still in there. You can yeah. still see the system.
Right.
It doesn't actually project the movie anymore. But it's this incredible space. And I again, Paper Moon, for those people who don't know, is a
Ryan O'Neill.
Yeah, a masterwork by Peter Bogdanovich, who yes. was at the height of his powers back then. Had just made, I guess, Last Picture Show or
just
or,
before that, yeah.
Yeah. And Ryan O'Neill, his daughter Tatum O'Neill, who gives maybe the greatest performance of any child actor ever. It
and
is.
Wins an Oscar.
Astonishing.
For it.
Yeah. Wins an Oscar, though. Supporting actress. Can you explain to me how the child in every shot in the movie gets the supporting actress?
Well, because dad's right beside her. So
yeah, but she wouldn't be nominated for best actor. But again, even back then, she can't win best actress, so let's push her for supporting. But how did they get away with that?
I know,
that's
right?
the lead role.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, she is phenomenal, and it's a film that's a period piece now because it was made in the 70s. Peter Bogdanovich introduced it.
Oh, yeah?
Told stories about Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock. Because before being an award-winning filmmaker, he was, at 20 years old, a film critic for Vogue or Vanity Fair.
Something like
and
that,
knew
yeah.
all these figures.
Yeah.
And does wicked impersonations of many of them. His Hitchcock impersonation was particularly dead on. But so you hear him talking.
Wait, how long did you do before the movie? Like an hour?
The event started at 8 p.m. Movie started around 9:40.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long night. But so he's telling about the process of making this film back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Which is really a different era of filmmaking.
Really?
So that's time travel.
Yeah.
And then the movie is set in the Depression.
Yeah.
And I just became aware, not only watching Paper Moon, but again watching one of the sing-along bouncing ball shorts beforehand from the era,
uh-huh.
that I was, again, in this, I had traveled time because I'm in this opulent picture palace from the 20s in a sold-out auditorium watching this pristine print of a very old movie that was set even longer ago than that, and almost all the audience was dressed to the nines.
Oh, were they?
Suits and ties. I mean, they were dressed up, and it was packed. And I certainly felt at least what it would be like to have been seeing Paper Moon upon its premiere in the early 70s when these films were roadshowed.
Yeah.
You know, they were only shown in a handful of theaters and they traveled around.
To
and people did
that.
Get dressed up to go to the picture show still. This was
right.
a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was such a fantastic experience.
Ah, so glad to hear it. There's plenty of other films that the LA Conservancy shows, and I recommend anyone who's never seen it to
this week,
go.
Big Sleep.
Big Sleep over at the Orpheum, isn't it? or is it at one of the theaters? They're showing Tootsie at the Orpheum, I think. It's
right, 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 right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did you see?
I finally saw The Avengers, which you had to see because it's $1.63 billion movie.
$1.3 billion It'll be up to $1.4 billion, as we talked about 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
And
did you like it?
I enjoyed it. Yes. It wasn't, you know, now it's overhyped, of course. So, and the trailer's bidding pretty much sold the movie out from under it. But
we can finally talk about this really briefly. Mark Ruffalo being cast as Bruce Banner, brilliant.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. They took the Hulk, which had two films based on the Hulk, neither of which worked.
No.
Talented directors, talented actors, they had yet to make it work. Hulk becomes the best part of the Avengers.
Absolutely. It's shockingly best part.
And Mark Ruffalo was so good. You know, I used to be a huge Mark Ruffalo fan. I got to the point, as we talked about with The Kids Are All Right, where I kind of felt like, you know what? I've seen what he does.
Yes. It's kind of done.
To put him now for the first time in an entirely different context, i.e. the context of big budget spectacle movie making, was to almost breathe life back into him as an actor.
Absolutely. And the way I love the underplaying of all the drama of being the Hulk. Like, he just underplayed every moment.
And how about the underplaying of the science scenes? Having just seen Prometheus, and we'll talk about this in a minute, it's so refreshing in a movie like Avengers, where you see the scene between Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo, and they're discussing science.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, because they're two scientific minds
working
discussing
away.
Science. It's refreshing to see Robert Downey Jr. on screen with an actor at his level.
Yeah, right? Sure.
It's fantastic to see these guys seemingly so effortlessly batting that ball back and forth.
Yeah.
Also, though, these two brilliant scientific minds so effortlessly bouncing these concepts back and forth, and to speak the way we think scientists probably do speak to each other.
Absolutely.
Which is a minimum of the technical jargon, and which is shorthand with each other.
Right, and that gets so much more information across, because you think all that technical shorthand is, well, the audience won't get the science unless we really spell it out for you. You know, well, no, that's not true. In fact, you get the science more by the shorthand. At least I thought so. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm glad I saw it. And then I saw Dark Shadows, Johnny Depp's.
Talk about a time capsule. Talk about time travel.
And talk about nailing tone, this thing.
You thought this was good.
I thought it was better than...
Because, dreadful reviews.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reviews...
Just a
dreadful marketing...
And a huge failure at the box office.
Huge failure. And I can see why. Because nobody, who watched Dark Shadows other than me and my brother in the 70s? Nobody
but I'm did. Shocked because it seemed to me the people who did watch it would be offended by this movie.
Yes. Well, only if you really loved the TV show.
Okay.
But if you thought the TV show was kind of crappy and campy, then here's the screenplay's problem. And not problem, but challenge. And the challenge they actually achieved. And the challenge is, how do you make something campy, yet a story, and not underplay or ironically comment on its campiness? So here's a movie that's campy without being a mockery of camp. Think about that challenge.
Yes.
That is an incredible challenge, and this movie actually achieves it.
So it celebrates camp.
It doesn't celebrate.
It just is.
It is camp.
Yes. Okay.
It contains the campiness within the.
And we've talked about this before. That tone seems almost impossible.
Almost
to
impossible.
Well,
and they
I can't wait now. I'm going to have to check this out.
It's remarkable. I mean, it totally nails exactly what the Dark Shadows TV series was, and steps it up in terms of budget and production values. But other than that, it has all the other notes correct. And to me, that's an incredible achievement for film. Maybe a misguided goal to have in the first place, because clearly nobody really appreciates it. But the fact that everybody was on that page to achieve that goal, to me, was pretty remarkable.
Well, I will be checking it out. That's very interesting.
Yes.
And it's why, there are cases where you have to be careful. I'm always one, I hate when I hear people say, oh, critics don't know. I pay no attention to the critics. well, how's that working for you? How much money are you blowing on shitty movies?
Yeah.
But you do also, you know, a consensus forms, but a consensus forms quickly. And comedy has always been one of those genres that how it plays right now, especially to a critic, might not be the lasting legacy
it's true.
Of a film.
Right.
And that's in fairness to the job that critics have to do. I mentioned Prometheus. You know, Ridley Scott is one of these filmmakers, again, who has certainly made movies in his life where how it was critically received did not end up being the critical legacy of the film. Blade Runner
being a perfect example
was trashed by critics everywhere except Los Angeles, and now it's hailed almost universally as one of the great science fiction films of all time.
Right. Prometheus, though?
Prometheus, a film I certainly was looking forward to, much of the world looking forward to. I saw it in a double feature weekend, Hollywood Film Society. They're at the Directors Guild, a Charlize Theron double bill of Snow White and the Huntsman.
Ah, very good.
With
Monsters. Oh,
with
no, no.
Prometheus,
oh, Prometheus
in
yeah.
3D. Snow White and the Huntsman from commercial director Rupert Sanders, written by John Lee Hancock, the writer-director of The Blind Side.
Oh, yeah.
And Hossein Amini, the writer of Drive, starring Ryan Gosling,
yeah.
and the period piece Wings of the Dove.
What?
How these writers seem like the guy for this Snow White movie, I don't understand. But what I don't understand, and I'm always kind of surprised by these movies, there are some scenes that are truly bad.
Yeah.
Kristen Stewart?
Kristen.
Who I actually started to get. I understood the appeal. I was going, yeah, she's a star. I am
attracted,
drawn to her. Right? I am rooting for her. She is given a St. Swithin's Day speech at the end that
oh, dear God.
It's here's a good idea. I will describe this from here in after as... Let's give Jackie Chan the opportunity to choreograph a fight scene on a beach or in sand, which is what they did in Cannonball Run.
Yeah, right.
Because they wanted to let him do what he did, but they knew that stuntmen couldn't keep up with him in the U.S., so we put him buried in sand where he can't jump or run fast. And this was like this.
Right.
You know, it's the equivalent of that with a rousing speech in the climactic scene of the film. So there are some scenes that are actively bad, but for the most part, I was aware of, this is not bad, so why am I never engaged? It reminded me a bit of Ridley Scott's Robin Hood.
Right.
You know, Russell Crowe, I spent watching that film going, well, this is good casting, that was well done, that made sense. And all I can say is what was absent was any sense at all of why they wanted to make it in the first place.
See, these are the goals you got to walk into a movie if you're not compelled to tell this story.
So that brings us to Prometheus, which is a film that has a lot of flaws in it. Some bad acting that is so astonishing because Ridley Scott has at times been so great with actors.
Right.
And these science scenes that are so hackneyed and poorly done. So there are some real flaws to it. At the same time, though, although I did not always love watching it, I loved this movie.
What?
I loved it because I loved its ambition and I loved the passion that they had for their own ideas and for exploring this world. And it is really unique in the way that it serves. A criticism has been leveled against it, and it's an interesting one, which is you feel at times like you're watching three different movies. You know, you're watching a prequel to Alien, you're watching a sequel to Alien, and then you're watching a movie that has nothing to do with Alien whatsoever, that's just this cool science fiction film. And it does function as both a prequel to the Alien that Ridley Scott made.
Yeah.
It contradicts nothing in anything in the Alien universe. Even the Alien versus Predator movies can be seen as canon based on this as a prequel.
Wow.
It just is kind of a setup for that first Alien movie.
Okay.
It also is a setup for a whole nother sequel that I believe they will pursue that will have nothing to do with Alien whatsoever, that will have to do with this origin quest of humanity.
Fascinating.
So it's...
But yet flawed, you couldn't watch it, and you loved it.
No, it's not that I couldn't watch it, but there were times when you're aware of its flaws, and it's... But I had so much so much love for the movie, so much affection for the
because
movie.
Because of its ambition, its goal.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and how hard it was working. And the fact that when it worked great.
Right. But I always think if for something to work, it should seem effortless. Avengers seemed effortless, you know, that just everything sort of came together. And there was, I mean, was there a reason to tell the story? Kinda.
Well, it gets to this issue of, you know, a man's reach should exceed its grasp.
Oh, okay.
His grasp, right? A film's reach should exceed its grasp.
Right, and, but its grasp is then dependent on talent. So,
well, no, untalented and, people. And ambition, again, right. And ambition. You know, how far were they reaching in Avengers? It's almost easy to get a little bit blasé about Avengers because it's easy to forget how hard that kind of movie is to make.
Yeah, that's
how
true.
Many failures led up to. I mean, a lot of these Marvel movies are not that much fun to sit through.
No,
they're,
hello, Green
they're
Arrow.
Chores.
Yeah,
and
Green Lantern. I mean,
although that was DC, right? Isn't Green Lantern DC?
Oh yeah, it is.
Who came out as gay in the comics?
Well,
right, the Green Lantern came out as gay.
They had to do something.
We'll mention nothing about Ryan Reynolds in this whatsoever.
Batwoman's a lesbian in the new DC universe.
So I guess, look, we're done.
We're done.
We're out of time. We're not even going to get to the lawsuit of the week, which is too bad because
too bad.
It involves Zhang Ziyi seeking legal recourse over, you know, this is the star of Crouching Tiger,
yeah,
Hidden
yeah.
Dragon, seeking legal recourse over not being allowed to leave the country because she... The story is that she's been making millions of dollars as a prostitute.
Wow.
Right? This is part of the big government corruption investigation that's going on.
Wow.
It's a big case about how ridiculous our news is now that so many people get it from bloggers and websites. And
okay,
so we'll be looking into that next
that's
week.
That's going to be fascinating.
And also, we got a lot of television suddenly to discuss.
Yes, we
so
do.
Much
so
good
much
television.
Good all of a sudden. I don't know, believe it or not.
So that'll be next week. And you'll be able to find that show.
Yes.
As well as this show.
Man,
as well as 100 installments of your Chill Pack Hollywood
so
Hour.
So many of them.
At chillpackhollywood.com. CHILLPAK Hollywood.com.
Follow us.
You can follow us on Twitter.
I'm at D. Haglin.
I'm at Phil Lernis. You can become a liker of the show.
Please like us.
At Facebook.
Yes.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can, of course, post comments.
Please.
And where you can now find every single one of all those hundreds
Yay,
of episodes.
Finally.
You can listen to them there on Facebook.
How about that?
Of course, you can listen to the most recent show. You can read a preview of the upcoming show at MySpace, myspace.com.
We're still there.
/ChillPackHollywood. You can listen to us on Jackalope Radio.
Please do.
TalkSuperStation.com.
They're great.
And you can write us, and we hope you will
yes.
personally. ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. Until next week, I'm Phil Lern.
I'm Dean Haglin. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.